This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1.
Hi, this is Bob Fetrakis bringing you The Other Side of the News. I've got the privilege today to have Cliff Arnebeck in the studio here on Broad Street. And Cliff has been involved not only in election integrity activities, ensuring election integrity in the U.S., but also in the question of excessive use of force by the police, particularly local police here in Central Ohio. Welcome to The Other Side of the News, Cliff Arnebeck.
Pleasure to be here, Bob.
You want to tell the listeners a little about your background. You're well known as an election integrity attorney. You were the lead attorney in the 2004 case that sought to overturn the Ohio vote, Moss v. Bush. How did you get involved with issues of excessive use of force by the police?
It's really odd. It was at one of the salons here at your place, Bob.
Sponsored by the Free Press, who in part brings you The Other Side of the News.
And there was a guy named, who's my friend, our friend, the organist.
Oh, Jerry Adderley.
Jerry Adderley was...
Who's a great keyboardist.
There was a break, and he goes up to the keyboard and starts a Ray Charles song, and it stops. So I chased him and said, "You got to finish that song. It's one of my favorite songs." And he said, "If you want to hear me play, you come to my church tomorrow," which I did. And at that church, it was an inner-city African-American church, Lord's Table at Kelton and East Livingston, and so it was a wonderful, wonderful service where three young black males sang. These are teenage kids, and I was very impressed. And 3 months later, there's a scene in the church where one of the ladies stands up and she's crying and holding her stomach. I said, "What's wrong with her?" "Well, you didn't hear, her son was shot." And at that point, I think he was 17 years old, and he'd been shot, and I went over to the hospital to see him, and he was all wired up, and he had been shot multiple times, and that's how I got involved in the police shootings. And he had two armed guards, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Protecting him?
Not protecting him, protecting against him, having articulating anything about what happened to him, and preventing his mother and grandmother, the grandmother being the evangelist for the church, the mother being one of the singers at the church. And so I intervened and made sure that they were able to visit with their son and grandson. And that's how I got involved. And I got intimately involved by talking to the to witnesses to the shooting, talking to police officers, a sergeant, and a homicide detective, and getting involved in testifying in his juvenile case, and following it very closely. And then the next incident was on Martin Luther King Day, and you asked me because
we had gotten a call from James Moss, right, Police Officers for Equal Rights, who organizes the Martin Luther King Day activity at the AME Church at 18th and Bryden, and he had called me, and I called you.
Yeah, and I went out and interviewed the witness that had contacted, directly or indirectly, had contacted Moss, James Moss, and he witnessed a shooting where young black man is walking down the street, and he's finds himself being approached by a police cruiser, and two officers getting out of their cruiser and coming after him with their guns drawn, and he starts running away in fear, and they shoot him in the back, and he falls and then gets up, and they shoot him again. And so I followed that and had multiple meetings with the mother and the young man. And both of these shooting in both of these shootings, the young men survived. So that's how I got involved.
So did it surprise you when it came out again? A former FBI agent and professor of criminology suggesting that Columbus was number two in the year 2011 in terms of per capita, in terms of police shootings. Did that surprise you at all?
It did surprise me that we were number two, because I thought, and I think I told you, I thought we had to be number one.
Okay.
When he had said, he had done his initial research, and he said we had eight times the rate of shootings, police shootings, of, I don't know if it was limited to black kids or not, but...
No, actually, it appears that the Columbus police, what could be said for them, in that year, they shot about 28%, which is about the percentage in the city. It appears that the Columbus police are equal opportunity shooters, except that if you look at it, the most egregious ones appear to happen in a black neighborhood. But you recall his data suggested also that we shoot the mentally ill with knives. If you're having a family member with an episode and mental instability and who grabs a knife and wants to kill themselves, call the police because they'll kill them for you.
Yeah. Well, I thought, given that we were eight times worse than New York City, that we would certainly be number one in the nation in police shootings.
But Las Vegas.
And then you did the analysis and came up with the conclusion that Las Vegas outdid us in police shootings.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least in 2011. And we continued with high numbers up until really last year. And I think you told me that you heard the current police chief, Chief Jacobs, sort of verify that those numbers had been fairly high. The previous chief, Dietzel Swig, may have had a different approach.
I think that's right. I attended a church presentation by Kim Jacobs yesterday, and she indicated that there had been about 5 years of shootings at an average rate of 19 a year, and that in 2014 it cut back, basically cut back to about half of that. And based upon what she presented earlier in that discussion before she got to that statistic, it was very clear that she had a very service-oriented approach to the office of being chief of police, and a very positive, very creative, wonderful indication of wonderful leadership. And I would say she said she wanted to know why it reduced, and I would say it's obvious to me that her approach to policing was dramatically different, and I would attribute it radical reduction to her leadership, that change of leadership.
Now, you've speculated in the past that some of the rash of shootings going back 5 years, six now, seven, that some of that may have been a carryover from policies that have been put in place by the Bush administration, particularly through his counsel there, Karl Rove.
Yes. One of the first things, one of the first programs that Karl Rove implemented was a program called Project Safe Neighborhoods. And this was implemented through the Justice Department. And the concept was to take a more proactive approach to controlling violent crime in cities. And legislation was put together and adopted, and there was substantial appropriation to give an incentive to metropolitan areas to implement a program where they would first analyze what were the high crime areas in the city, and then secondly analyze who are the What are the demographics of the perpetrators of these crimes? And then thirdly, come up with more aggressive police practices to try to intercept on a more proactive basis, intercept the criminal activity before it resulted in killings, et cetera.
And what's wrong with that approach?
Well, the what's wrong with that approach is that it becomes a it ends up being gee, where is the crime? It's in the inner city.
And minority areas.
Yeah, and gee, who are the perpetrators? Oh, it's young black males. And so you end up, I mean, that's called racial profiling when you say we're going into the community, those communities, with the approach that when you see these young black males out there, particularly when they're gathered together, they're probably up to something. And you probably know this better than I, Bob, but Columbus adopted a program called Summer Safety
Initiatives.
Here in Columbus.
The SSI.
And the popular perception of this is that it resulted in a program of jump outs, where police officers, seeing a couple of two or three young black males gathered together, would jump out and with guns drawn and give chase.
Yeah, in part the program was to put undercover white cops, you know, with money, possible paraphernalia that looked like drugs, into high crime areas and have them sit there in their car like they were stoned and wait for somebody to approach them. And they became known as, quote, the jump out boys, which resulted with some shootings. And some have questioned whether or not that was entrapment. And in many cases, the witnesses often said the people being shot were running and didn't have guns. And from the police reports, always, you know, had them threatening the cops, turning back to shoot, or having guns when others would say they didn't see guns.
Well, then this program was not that long in place, but the effects of that program, this training and these methods, seem to have carried over and affected the conduct of the police department subsequently. And I think that's what's behind the high rate of police shootings. And then, you know, in terms of my personal involvement, I was asked to pick up a case that the attorney who originally had it became ill, and I picked up this case late in the game. And but it's the Obie Shepherd shooting, and the young man was riding a bike in an inner city neighborhood, and police officers approached him in their vehicle, backed over his bike. He was off and running, and they were chasing and shot him to death. And as I understand it, witnesses say he didn't have a gun. It was obvious he didn't have a gun. He didn't shoot a gun. He didn't shoot at the officers. As I understand it, when they say they found a gun 100 yards from the where he was shot, but the DNA testing, which they're trying to associate him with, mm-hmm. that gun, it reads that he can't be excluded as one of the people who might have handled that gun, because it was a mix of people who handled that gun. And it just seems strange when you're talking about, and I'm not an expert, but when they're saying it's more likely that an African American handled this gun than an Oriental or a Caucasian, that doesn't seem like a firm ID, you know, positive ID that this is Obie Shepherd's gun. So, but this is a case where overly excessive use of force, was involved, and it's tragic. And in terms of where this, what's the source of this problem? I say the source of this problem is this Karl Rove's initiative, using his policy position in the White House to in effect establish a sort of a enhanced Jim Crow strategy to further disrupt the black community, adversely affect the reputation of African Americans, and that's the source, in my opinion, and I've so testified at one point.
This is WCRS 98.3, 102.1. You're listening to The Other Side of the News with Bob Fitrakis. I've got attorney Cliff Arnebeck in the studio. So where did you testify?
I testified in a juvenile hearing, and in terms of what was the source, you know, was it the police officer's fault? What's the source of the excessive use of force? I testify that I put the blame on Karl Rove.
Now, you've been involved in politics over the years, back in the 80s, associated at fairly high levels with the Republican Party. You went with Ross Perot in 92 and transitioned into a Democrat, even ran for Congress as a Democrat, so you've been around in terms of public policy. You've thought about these things long and hard as an attorney and have been involved in questions of excessive use of force by the police. How, in your perspective, do we go from 100,000 people in prison in 1970 to seven times that after the sort of Nixon years, a sevenfold increase in the 70s corresponding to globalization, but even beyond that, when you get to 800,000 or so, a tripling during the Reagan years, and words coming into the vocabulary like a prison industrial complex. Is there one in your mind, and does it target minorities and poor people?
Absolutely. And the there's a Bible written on this. This text is so authoritative, so well documented, so beautifully stated. It's a book, the name
that it has to be ignored by most mainstream politicians because it's fact-based.
The name of the book is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness. And it's by Michelle Alexander, who we have the privilege of having here in Ohio as a professor at the Kerwin Institute on Race and Ethnicity, mm-hmm. and at the law school at Ohio State. And she is the author. She has spoken about this around the country and on television, radio, etc. It can't be stated better than she stated it in the book and in her oral presentations. And everyone should read this book. And it explains on page 43...
Uh-huh.
That the origin of the war on drugs is a statement by President Richard Nixon that our problem, meaning Republicans, our problem as Republicans is the blacks, and we have to do something about it, but it can't be obvious. And that's the source of the war on drugs, because the facts are that the popularity of marijuana use was just as popular with whites as it was with blacks, but the enforcement was against the blacks, going into the inner cities and making arrests and so on and so forth, grossly disproportionately to the extent of use in the general society.
So you're asserting they were politically targeted for essentially voting black?
Exactly. And it's not just voting while black, but this has a distinctive implication. Blacks have been smart enough to recognize which party is out to get them and which party's trying to help them. And they vote at a very high percentage, 85, 90% Democratic. So Richard Nixon recognized.
Even beyond that, 97% in the Romney race of 2012, and that's with a plus or minus three factor.
So when Richard Nixon, a very shrewd guy, he accurately recognized that that kind of solid voting block in the numbers in which we have of black citizens in this country is a problem for the Republicans, and that a covert strategy of undermining that community in a variety of ways to reduce their voting power was a way to make the Republican Party competitive.
I'm in the studio here with Cliff Arnebeck. We're talking about the issue of excessive use of force by police. Did the recent report, and you may not have seen it in full, but I'm sure you've read the accounts of it, the recent Justice Department report on Ferguson surprise you in any way?
No. It's saying that what is evident in Ferguson is evident around the country, and again, this goes back to...
I mean, the systematic targeting of black people, particularly black youth, stopping them, writing them tickets, encountering them, disproportionately sucking money out of that community?
Absolutely. And it's recognizing as the NAACP has recognized, as the Rainbow Push has recognized, as Al Sharpton's group has recognized, that there has been an attack on the black community, and it's and all of those folks, you can bet, have read Michelle Alexander's book, and on that basis there was a team effort to advocate for the repeal of the war on drugs on the anniversary of that legislation.
And we had some of our own problems here in Columbus in the Driving Park area, in this case coming from the state troopers. Governor John Kasich, when he took over, set up three new urban outposts for the state troopers, and the state troopers decided they would go into a black inner city neighborhood and wrote hundreds of tickets and took out, you know, tens of thousands of dollars from a lower class, working class, overwhelmingly black neighborhood not that far from where we sit here.
The tactics seem to be, it amazes me that they repeat these things. And
do you think Kasich's action was political in nature?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this article, Greg Palast's article on the... tying, if you have a different middle name, you have a same
first or similar name or same date of birth.
In different states, they're assuming that that's probable cause to believe that you're voting in multiple states. I mean, I'm a junior.
What are you suggesting? People don't get in planes or cars and race to other states the same day to vote, Cliff?
No, I mean, it's quite common for there to be lots of people with the same first name and last name, and I'll bet you...
Particularly in the plantation system, because there was a limited amount of plantations, and many blacks, the name Jackson, etc., many of them have very similar names because they took the name of the slave master, the plantation owner.
Yeah, but this is the Republicans taking advantage of the fact that they stole all these elections in 2010 in order to create the...
Past 2004, you think they stole elections since then as well?
I think the biggest theft was 2010. And I think what they did is apply the 6% redshift all across the board.
And by redshift, you mean?
I mean the shifting of Democratic votes to the Republican side.
Proven by the exit polls?
Proven by the exit polls.
So the exit polls, people come out and say how they voted, considered the gold standard. By International Election Observer, which I was one of those. One of the ways you look for fraud is you look at the exit polls, which have a very small margin of error, usually 1%. And people coming out in 2010 6% of them said they voted a different way. There was an actual shift. 3% of the vote appeared to be shifted through whatever mechanism, I would suspect, through privately controlled machines that are controlled by partisan for-profit companies that support the Republican Party.
And electronic machines, which are certified by the CIA and by any respectable scientific research organization as not safe for voting, insecure, and in the hands of partisan corporations who have a record, a track record of cheating, cheating on the votes. So it's really preposterous that this has gone on so long.
So you see it all tied together.
Absolutely.
The targeting of blacks by the police and the targeting of black voters.
Yes. And of course, the electronic voting, with the electronic, it used to be that the rigging was focused on the shifting was focused in black communities, because when you shifted a vote in a black community, an inner city community, you said, we're 90% sure we're shifting from a Republican to a Democrat.
Yeah, just percentage-wise, 90-95% up to 97% here in Ohio in the 2012 election, is that if you wanted to shift the vote, your best probability is a black vote if you're shifting it from Democrat to Republican if you're cheating. It's much more difficult to see such massive patterns in the white population.
But with the electronic voting coming in, it's easier to make these shifts.
With a keystroke.
More generally, it's a much easier system.
Well, but don't they look at the source code?
Who? You can be sure the guys that are writing it are looking at it.
Yeah, the source code is protected under intellectual property rights, and you're not allowed to look at who wrote the source code. So those of you out there in the open source movement might take offense at the fact that the election officials never get to look at the source code.
Our expert at the time had offered to write the code for electronic voting machines.
And who was that?
Stephen Spoonamore. He said he would do it for free. And this is one of the top mathematicians in the world and cybersecurity experts in the world. And he would do it for free because he says it's very simple to write a vote program. It's very simple. And when you look at the programs that the companies come up with, they're very intricate. They're very long and intricate. And that is where you can bury malicious code.
Yes, indeed. And now we can do it in malware and other factors. You also had another individual you put under oath here in Columbus who claimed to have actually written malevolent code that would switch votes. Did you not?
Absolutely. A fellow from Florida who was asked by the Speaker of the House in Florida, Republican, to write some software for election rigging, and he did, and he testified that that code is something that could be very simple. It would be very difficult to discover, and it happened back in Florida at the time of the 2000 election.
Well, 1 minute left, Cliff Arnebeck. What would you tell the listeners? What do we need to really do to get beyond this new Jim Crow?
Well, we need to have the media, not just Bob Fetrakis and the Free Press, but the major media, the television, radio, and newspapers. It's very difficult for the courageous reporters in those segments of the media to do it, but they need to follow your example and report on this stuff. Because if the public was generally aware of this, it couldn't go on.
Thank you, Cliff Arnebeck, for being on The Other Side of the News.
Pleasure to be here.